this week, the sun, the moon, and the stars. Our education is directly inspired by the recent Artemis moon mission that ended with a splashdown this past Sunday. A successful mission of 1.3 million miles through our solar system and back to Earth. In the article on the sun, moon, and stars, we talk about the scientific explanations of astronomy within Freemasonry and what some of our symbols are connected to. Then, in part 3 of the Christmas-themed Masonic Mythbusters, Worshipful Brother Patrick Day talks about the date that Jesus was born. December? April? March? When did it happen? And what do we know? Well, Brother Day gives us the root of all the theories in this excellent new segment. Also this week, we're talking about how you can win an exclusive gift set from the Southern California Research Lodge. Finally, we'll wrap it up with a contemplative exercise talking about the importance of delegation. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 574. Our thanks goes out to the contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Without you, we cannot make this podcast, and without you, we cannot make those continued progressive steps to make the show better and better and better, and continue to invest in Masonic education and its kindred sciences to bring that information, trusted Masonic information, to the world. So I want to say thank you to those folks who make this show possible, and if you're curious on how you can support this show, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and check out the links. We've got various ways to support the show, either through Patreon or through PayPal. We've also got a shop and a bookstore with Amazon affiliate links to the books written and recommended by guests on the show, myself, and others. I heard you all loud and clear. It's Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I'll be there on the 13th giving a lecture called Freemasonry, A History of Mystery. Where did we really come from? What's the purpose of the Masonic fraternity's existence? What is the divine relation of our ritual? So in this keynote address, we're going to explore all these things, and by the end of it, you'll be ready to work with your lodge and hopefully change the world. I'll be at Eau Claire 112 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I'm really looking forward to sharing some fellowship. So what else happened in the news? Well, we had the historic moon mission that just ended with a splashdown of the Orion capsule. This is directly related to the progressive science of astronomy. I will post a link which has a pretty good rundown of the events, but essentially the Artemis 1 mission, which was a 25.5-day uncrewed test flight, which went around the moon and was meant to pave the way for future astronaut missions to the moon and beyond, came to this momentous end as NASA's Orion spacecraft made a successful ocean splashdown today when I'm recording this. It splashed down at 12:40 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday in the Pacific Ocean off Mexico's Baja California. It traveled about 32 times the speed of sound. So that's about 24,850 miles per hour or 40,000 kilometers per hour as it hit the air. The Orion spacecraft traveled nearly 1.3 million miles, or 2 million kilometers, during this mission on a path that swung out to a lunar distant orbit, carrying the capsule farther than any spacecraft designed to carry humans has ever traveled. So pretty amazing. Details I'll post for anybody who's interested in checking them out in the CNN's website, which has a pretty decent too long didn't read or TLDR of the entire event. But why I bring this up is that there is such a emphasis on astrological and star charts and natal charts and things this time of year that it was kind of interesting to bring up, especially because our education piece for this week is called The Sun, Moon, and Stars. It comes from universalfreemasonry.org. It was published just a few days ago on the 7th and is by Unknown. The sun, the moon, and the stars are central symbols in Freemasonic philosophy, but what has Freemasonry and its ancestors in the ancient mysteries contributed to the science of astronomy? We have more right to be astonished that the astronomical references are so few, rather than to be surprised that there are so many. We are taught that geometry and masonry were originally synonymous terms, and geometry, fifth of the seven liberal arts and sciences, is given more prominence in our fellowcraft degree than the seventh, astronomy. Yet the beginnings of astronomy far antedate the earliest geometrician. Indeed, geometry came into existence to answer the ceaseless questionings of man as to the why of celestial phenomena. In these modern days, it is difficult to visualize the vital importance of the heavens generally to early man. We can hardly conceive of their terror of the eclipse and the comet, or the sense of their veneration for the sun and his bride, the moon. We are too well educated. We know too much about the quote-unquote proportions which connect this vast machine. The astronomer has pushed back the frontiers of his science beyond the inquiries of most of us. The questions which occur as a result of unaided visual observations have all been answered. We have substituted facts for fancies regarding the sun, the moon, the solar system, the comet, and the eclipse. Albert Pike, the great Masonic student, quote-unquote, who found masonry in a hovel and left her in a palace, says, "We cannot even in the remotest degree feel, though we may partially and imperfectly imagine how those great, primitive, simple-hearted children of nature felt in regard to the starry hosts. There upon the slopes of the Himalayas, on the Chaldean plains, in the Persian and Midian deserts, and upon the banks of the great strange river, the Nile, to them the universe was alive, instinct with forces and powers, mysterious and beyond their comprehension. To them it was no machine, no great system of clockwork, but a great live creature, in sympathy with or inimical to man. To them all was mystery and a miracle, and the stars flashing overhead spoke to their hearts almost in an audible language. Jupiter, with its kingly splendors, was the emperor of the starry legions. Venus looked lovingly on the earth and blessed it. Mars, with its crimson fires, threatened war and misfortune, and Saturn, cold and grave, chilled and repelled them. The ever-changing moon, faithful companion of the sun, was a constant miracle and wonder. The sun himself, the visible emblem of the creative and generative power. To them, the earth was a great plain, over which the sun, the moon, and the planets revolved its servants, framed to give it light. Of the stars, some were beneficent existences that brought with them springtime and fruits and flowers, some faithful sentinels advising them of coming inundations, of the season of storm and deadly winds, some heralds of evil, which, steadily foretelling, they seemed to cause. To them, the eclipse were portents of evil and their causes hidden in mystery and supernatural. The regular returns of the stars, the comings of Arcturus, Orion, Sirius, the Pleiades, and Aldebaran, and the journeyings of the sun were voluntary and not mechanical to them. What wonder that astronomy became to them the most important of sciences, that those who learned it became rulers, and the vast edifices, the pyramids, the tower or temple of Bel, and other like erections elsewhere in the East were builded for astronomical purposes. And what wonder that, in their great childlike simplicity, they worshipped the light, the sun, the planets, and the stars, and personified them, and eagerly believed in their histories invented for them, in that age when the capacity for belief was infinite, as indeed, if we but reflect, it still is, and ever will be." End quote. Anglo-Saxons usually consider history as their history, science as their science, religion as their religion. This somewhat naive viewpoint is hardly sustainable, substantiated by a less egoistic survey of knowledge. Columbus's sailors believed that they would quote-unquote fall off the edge of a flat world, yet Pythagoras knew the earth to be a ball. The ecliptic was known before Solomon's temple was built. The Chinese predicted eclipses long, long before the Europeans of the Middle Age quit regarding them as portents of doom. Astronomical lore of Freemasonry is very old. The foundations of our degrees are far more ancient than we can prove by documentary evidence. It is surely not stretching credulity to believe that the study, which antedates geometry, the first and noblest of sciences, must have been impressed on our order, its ceremonies and its symbols, long before Preston and Webb worked their ingenious revolutions in our rituals and gave us the system of degrees we use, in one form or another today. The astronomical references in our degrees begin with the points of the compasses, east, west, and south, and the place of darkness, the north, We are taught the reason why the north is a place of darkness by the position of Solomon's temple with reference to the ecliptic, a most important astronomical conception. The sun is the past master's own symbol. Our masters rule their lodges, or are supposed to, with the same regularity with the sun rules the day and the moon governs the night. Our explanation of our lesser lights is obviously an adaptation of a concept which dates back to the earliest of religions, specifically to the Egyptian Isis, Osiris, and Horus, represented by the sun, the moon, and Venus. Circumambulation about the altar is in imitation of the course of the sun. We traverse our lodges from east to west by way of the south, as did the sun worshippers, who thus imitated the daily passage of their deity through the heavens. Measures of time are wholly a matter of astronomy. Days and nights were before man, and consequently before astronomy. But hours and minutes, high 12, low 12, are inventions of the mind, depending on the astronomical observation of the sun at meridian to determine noon, and consequently all other periods of time. Indeed, we are taught this in the middle chamber work, in which we give to geometry the premier place as a means by which the astronomer may, quote-unquote, fix the duration of times and seasons, years and cycles. Atop the pillars representing those in the porch of King Solomon's temple appear the terrestrial and celestial globes. In the Fellowcraft degree, we are told, in beautiful and poetic language, that numberless worlds are around us, all framed by the same divine artist, which roll through the vast expanse and are all conducted by the same unerring law of nature. End quote. Our ancient brethren, observing that the sun rose and set easily, determining east and west in a general way, as the rises and sets through a variation of 47 degrees north and south during a six-month period, the determination was not exact. The earliest Chaldean stargazers, progenitors of the astronomers of later ages, saw that the apparently revolving heavens pivoted on a point nearly coincident with a certain star. We know that the true north diverges about from the north star 1 1/2 degrees, but their observations were sufficiently accurate to determine a north, and consequently east, west, and south. The reference to the ecliptic and the sublime degree has puzzled many a brother who has not studied the elements of astronomy. The earliest astronomers defined the ecliptic as the hypothetical circular plane of the Earth's path about the sun, with the sun in the center. As a matter of fact, the sun is not in the center, and the Earth's path about the sun is not circular. The Earth travels once about the sun in 365 days and a fraction on an ecliptic path. The sun is at one of the foci points of the ellipse. The axis of the Earth, about which it turns once in 24 hours, thus making a night and a day, is inclined to this hypothetical plane by 23 1/2 degrees. At one point in its yearly path, the north pole of this Earth is inclined toward the sun by this amount. Halfway further around in its path, the north pole is inclined away from the sun by this angle. The longest day in the northern hemisphere, June 21st, occurs when the North Pole is most inclined toward the sun. A building situated between latitudes 23 1/2 north and 23 1/2 south of the equator will receive the rays of the sun at meridian, high 12 or noon, from the north at some time during the year. King Solomon's temple at Jerusalem began, being in latitude 31 degrees 47 seconds north, lay beyond this limit. At no time in the year, therefore, did the sun or moon at meridian dart its rays into the northerly portion thereof. As astronomy in Europe is comparatively modern, some have argued that this reason for considering the north Masonically as a place of darkness must also be comparatively modern. This is wholly mistaken. Pythagoras, to go further back, recognized the obliquity of the world's axis to the ecliptic, as well as the earth was a sphere suspended in space. While Pythagoras, around 510 BCE, is much younger than Solomon's temple, he is almost 2,000 years older than the beginnings of astronomy in Europe. The world celestial and terrestrial on the brazen pillars were added by modern ritual makers. Solomon knew them not, but contemporaries of Solomon believed the heavens to be a sphere revolving around the earth. To them, the earth stood still, a hollow sphere with its inner surface dotted with stars. The slowly turning celestial sphere is as old as mankind's observations of the starry-decked heavens. It is to be noted that terrestrial and celestial spheres are both used as emblems of universality. They are not mere duplications for emphasis. They teach their own individual part of universality. What is universal on Earth, as for instance the necessity of mankind to breathe, drink, water, and eat in order to live, is not necessarily universal in all the universe. We have no knowledge that any other planet in our solar system is inhabited. What evidence there is rather to the contrary. We have no knowledge that any other sun has any inhabited planets in its system. Neither have we any knowledge that they have not. If life does exist in some other, to us unknown world, it may be entirely different from life on this planet. Hence, a symbol of universality which applied only to Earth would be a self-contradiction. Real universality means what it says. It appertains to the whole universe. While a Mason's charity, considered as giving relief to the poor and distressed, must obviously be confined to this particular planet, this charity of thought may, so we are taught, extend through the boundless realms of eternity. Hence the world terrestrial and the world celestial, on our representations of the pillars, in denoting universality, mean that the principles of our order are not founded upon mere earthly conditions and transient truths, but rest upon divine and limitless foundations, coexistent with the whole cosmos and its creator. We are taught of the all-seeing eye, whom the sun, moon, and stars obey, and under whose watchful care even comets perform their stupendous revolutions. In this astronomical reference is, oddly enough, a potent argument both for the extreme care in the transmission of ritual unchanged from mouth to ear, and the urgent necessity of curbing well-intentioned brethren who wish to improve the ritual. The word revolution in this paragraph, it is so printed in the earliest web monitors, fixes it as a comparatively modern conception. Tycho Brahe, progenitor of the modern maker and user of the fine instruments among astronomers, whose discoveries have left an indelible impression on astronomy, made no attempt to consider comets as orbital bodies. Galileo thought them emanations of the atmosphere. Not until the 17th century was well underway did a few daring spirits suggest that these celestial portents of evil, these terribly heavenly demons which had inspired terror in the hearts of men for uncounted generations, were actually part of the solar system, and that many, if not most of them, were periodic, actually returning again and again, in other words, that they revolved about the sun. Obviously, then, this passage of our ritual cannot have come down to us by a word of mouth, transmission from an epoch earlier than that in which men first commenced to believe that a comet was not an augury of evil, but a part of the solar system. The so-called lunar lodges have a far more practical than astronomical basis. In the early days of Masonry, both in England and in this country, many, if not most, lodges met on dates fixed in advance. But according to the time when the moon was full, not because the moon governed the night, but because it illuminated the traveler's path. In days when roads were but muddy paths between town and hamlet, when any journey was hazardous, and on black nights dangerous in the extreme, the natural illumination of the moon making the road easy to find and the depredations of highwaymen the more difficult, was a matter of some moment. One final curious derivation of Masonic symbol from the heavens and we are through. The symbol universally associated with the stewards of a Masonic lodge is the cornucopia. According to the mythology of the Greeks, which go back to the very dawn of civilization, the god Zeus was nourished in infancy from the milk of a goat, Amaltea. In gratitude, the god placed Amaltea forever in the heaven as a constellation, but first gave one of Amaltea's horns to his nurses with the assurance that it would forever pour for them whatever they desired. The horn of plenty, or the cornucopia, is thus a symbol of abundance. The goat from which it came may be found by the curious among the constellations of the name Capricorn. The Tropic of Capricorn of our school days is the southern limit of the swing of the sun on the path which marks the ecliptic on which it inclines first its north and then its south pole toward our luminary. Hence there is a connection not the less direct for being tenuous between our stewards, their symbol, the lights in the lodge, the place of darkness, and Solomon's temple. Of such curious links and interesting bypaths is the study of astronomy and its connection with Freemasonry. The more beautiful when we see eye to eye with the psalmist in the greater light, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Unknown. Well, there you have a rather scientific and also quite poetic explanation of the sun, moon, and stars and some of their connections with Freemasonry. It is rather interesting and perhaps can be a bit upsetting to, let's say, the new Mason who may not understand that all of the allegory is not based in some sort of grounded fact, but rather is an allegory intended to convey to you different values and stories. So at a point within our allegory, we diverge from factual and even possible things in order to convey ideas to you. And in this same way, this article points out, you know, several different instances in which the allegory is irreconcilable with facts. You know, Solomon doesn't know about certain things that, you know, we study today in Freemasonry and outside of things, but that shouldn't change the message. We really shouldn't get hung up on the thing. I think something that is interesting is there's a saying that we've heard again and again, which is, don't mistake the meaning of the thing for the thing itself, or something along those lines, and that we should always look for the deeper significance of something. It's not actually a factual thing that's happening, but rather an idea that words are trying to uncover for your own mind. But for our Craftsman Plus, what other astronomical significances have you found within Freemasonry? Whether that be the Symbolic Lodge, Scottish York Rites, the KT, or some other Masonic body, or if you've got some cool references or articles to share with our brethren in the group, please do so. So as part of the news, I wanted to throw this out there. Now, some of you who follow me on TikTok under The Wizard of Arge saw that I said we were going to have a little contest where we were going to win something. I revealed what it was. If you don't know, you could check out that video, or you could just keep listening. Check this out. So for immediate release, Southern California Research Lodge Fraternal Review Magazine. The Fraternal Review releases its winter limited edition gift set on the three principal tenets. The editors of the Southern California Research Lodge's Fraternal Review publication are pleased to deliver to you an advanced limited edition gift set of the three principal tenets, available nationwide right now, you guys, exclusively through our website at theresearchlodge.com/three tenets. For the first time ever, the three principal tenet issues are together in this unique educational collection. The gift will include all three issues originally released in 2021 and edited by C. Douglas Russell. The issues are Brotherly Love, Relief, and Truth. This gift set also includes three greeting cards with envelopes, each displaying one of the principal tenets and appropriate descriptive Masonic text. These cards were created exclusively for this gift set. Also, one unique lapel pin available only in this collection. All items are neatly packaged in an original art design folder, hand-numbered to indicate a special, one-time-only limited edition of 300 sets. Each set retails for $55, which includes online transaction and shipping fees. The three principal tenets are groundbreaking consecutive fraternal review issues released in the late fall of 2021. October, November, and December timeframe. Intended to educate and inspire Masons and non-Masons alike during these challenging social and post-pandemic times. Masonic scholars contributing to these three issues include Angel Millar, Matthew Parker, Jedediah French, Robert Sachs, Charles Chuck Dunning, John L. Cooper, Bob Davis, Stephen Doan, Jamie Paul Lamb, Douglas Russell, and many others. Now you can have all three seminal issues in one beautifully illustrated limited edition set to enjoy for yourself or as a gift to a friend or family member. This gift set is excellent for the Mason who has everything, for a newly made Mason, or an installation gift for lodge officers. It will also beautifully complement any Masonic library. Feel free to share it with your admired listeners, readers, friends starting today and through its initial December 2022 launch. Again, the gift set includes the custom-made limited edition folder, which is hand-numbered 1 through 300. The one I am giving away is all packaged up neatly for you. I haven't even taken the shrink wrap off of it. You'll get the Brotherly Love, Relief, and Truth issues, 3 greeting cards and envelopes, and that exclusive lapel pin. They are, again, $55 on the website, and I encourage you to want to get this. So what am I doing? I got this extra set to give away. So I am going to give this away. I'm shipping it to you. There's no cost. And I'm also going to include a copy of illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison's Freemasonry's Journey West, which is an exclusive sort of publication that is really the first part of Freemasonry Crosses the Mississippi and is an excellent historical text if you're interested in Freemasonry and its history across the United States. So both of those gifts I'm going to give away, and here's how you're going to win. You're going to send an email to me at admin@wcypodcast.com, or you can go to the website and fill out a contact form, whichever is easier for you. And you're going to win by submitting a short essay, 300 to 500 words. Now, 500 words is a full page, so it's not a whole lot. 300 to 500 words on one of the topics, brotherly love, relief, or truth. All the essay submissions will be compiled, and we'll choose a winner, and we'll read your essay on the show, and the gift set goes to you. We'll need your submissions all sent in by the 20th of December. Your essay will be read on the next show following the 20th. This is the call. It is the 11th of December. We need your essays by the 20th. We'll pick a winner by the 22nd. We'll announce the winner. We'll email you back to let you know. And we're going to read your essay on the next episode, which might be a Christmas Day episode. I'm not sure yet. Usually we go dark, but we may do a special episode. So either on the 25th, the 1st, or on the 8th of January. But we will make sure we send out your stuff the second we know who the winner is, so probably about the 22nd. So you'll probably get it either if you're in the United States, U.S. people only for this contest. This contest is open for anybody in the continental United States and Alaska as well. Happy to send those out. I just can't do international on this one, so I do apologize for our international listeners. If we send it out on the 23rd, you will get it by the, hopefully before the 30th of the month. So best of luck. Remember, 300 to 500 words on either brotherly love, relief, or truth. And we need that by the 20th. Best of luck. Now, let's get into the third part in a special series of Masonic-themed Christmas Masonic myth-busting segments. This week, as you heard, Patrick is going to give us the scoop on why some consider Jesus' birthday to be in April. Let's check it out.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Part 3 of Christmas Myths. You've probably seen this one running around on your social media feeds that Jesus was actually born in April. I usually see this said by people who also don't believe Jesus was real, so that's funny. So, was Jesus born in April? Where did that even come from? Ugh. So, first things first. We have absolutely no idea when Jesus was born. He was a poor commoner living in the not-so-great neighborhood of Nazareth. There were people born only a couple of centuries ago in which we don't know what their birth dates were, and we believe we're going to know when someone 2,000 years ago was born. That fact being up front, let's dig into why some people say he was born in April. Now, it seems like this is something someone heard, but they can never really tell you why it is so, much less provide a source for it. Early Christians like today were obsessed with figuring out when Jesus was born. However, they used Roman calendrical significance as their reasoning for using December 25th. What is 9 months, the length of a human fetal gestation. What is 9 months before December 25th? March 25th, roughly the vernal equinox, when the Romans observed the start of the new year. I've talked about this before, but I'll briefly reiterate. December 25th, 274 AD, was dedicated to Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, by Emperor Aurelius, who adopted this new deity from the queer, probably transgender emperor Elagabalus, who introduced the Syrian sun god to Rome, whom he called Sol Invictus, hence his adopted name of Elagabalus. Thus, 3rd century Christians, who were Romans, saw their god, Jesus, as the unconquered sun. And this fits with the 9-month gestation of a human fetus conceived at the beginning of the year. All that is just Roman customs, Romans being Romans, and calendrical significance, and is not definitive of establishing the birth date of Jesus. In the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and even on up until the Enlightenment, natal charts were used to try and establish when Jesus was born, just based on astrological significance. Biblical literalism was also used, such as John 2:20, in which it is stated that the temple had been around for 46 years, which would have been about 28 AD, and Luke 3:23 states that Jesus was 30 when he began his ministry, so thus Jesus was born around 1 BC. Hence, Anno Domino, AD, Year of Our Lord. Though it's kind of odd we do BC, before Christ, in English, but Anno Domino in Latin. I suppose this is because the Latin ante Christum sounds too close to Antichrist. Whatever. The year of Jesus' birth was important if early Christians were going to be dating things starting from when he was born. However, the year is all fine and dandy, but what day of the year was he born? After the 3rd century, Christians didn't usually question December 25th, as that was generally regarded as heresy to challenge. I guess no one wanted to reconfigure all the feast days if Christmas was changed. While the year was almost always up for debate, and frequently was debated, but the day of the year was a big question mark for anyone who wanted to challenge it. It's not until the advent of calculus and planetary physics that calculating the position of celestial bodies became an opportunity to possibly date the appearance of the star Bethlehem, which is only mentioned in the Gospel of Matthew. This is where it gets speculative, as if all of this wasn't already highly speculative. This now means we have to figure out what is the star in the east. It is stated that the star appeared, so it must have been a recent phenomenon in the heavens that only remained for a brief period. However, it may have risen, though that complicates matters. It just depends on how you interpret the word in Greek. Now, some have claimed it was a comet, other a conjunction of major planets, or maybe a supernova. But a supernova would have been a worldwide event, and we actually do see other descriptions of it in other regions of the world. So we have observed celestial phenomenon that may be remnants of this hypothetical supernova. There is one pulsar, the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, in the constellation of Kylla, that is believed to have exploded roughly in 4 BC. It is reported in Korean accounts, though their calendars back then, terms they would use, make it confusing, but it's believed to have been February 23rd or 24th BC. Maybe one date for the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. Or, according to Chinese records, April 24th that same year. Only one source gives us the circa 5-4 BC time frame, and that's Josephus, but for an entirely different phenomenon. a lunar eclipse. Now, according to Book 17, Section 7-4, Herod died after a lunar eclipse, but before Passover. Such did occur in a seventh-month time frame in 5 BC, but the same would happen in a month span in 4 BC. Eclipses, they tend to be cycles. They tend to happen every so often in a series of clusters. So this would mean the Star of Bethlehem was a lunar eclipse? It would be weird to call a lunar eclipse a star. I mean, they had a word for the moon. And they may have not had a word for a supernova. Anyway, I digress. However, Herod's discussions with the Magi, those Persian astrologer priests that visit the Christ child, that does make dating even weirder. Herod ordered the execution of any male child born within the last 2 years, so that may mean that the Christ child was born 2 years prior. Yeah, it's getting complicated. If you're going to use the Bible as an infallible chronology of the world, you're going to get into trouble. And given the use of time frames, we are not any closer to a birth date. Let's go back to conjunctions. Johannes Kepler calculated a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in 7 BC that may have been the Star of Bethlehem. But Kepler thought it was actually a supernova. He thought great conjunctions, like conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, would cause a supernova. Yep, weird. You may remember many called the Great Conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn on December 21st, 2020, the Christmas star. However, they do not appear to have eclipsed each other or gotten very close to each other in 7 BC as they did in 2020. And there are really no records from this period in the Near East describing this event. Some have speculated Jupiter eclipsing the star Regulus in the constellation of Leo may have been the Star of Bethlehem, there being several such occultations in 3 and 2 BC with a near conjunction of Jupiter, Venus, and Regulus on June 17, 2 BC. A conjunction of Jupiter and Venus would signify the birth of a king. A lot of astrological concepts get pulled into the argument for Jupiter, Venus, and Regulus as signifying Jesus' birth in 2-3 BC. Some arguing that Jupiter's occultation of Regulus was the conception of Jesus. Then Jupiter moves and 9 months later conjuncts Venus, signifying the birth. Another astrologer argues that Jupiter would have gone retrograde around December 25th, 2 BC, thus appearing to slow and then stop in motion over Bethlehem, thus being an interim of a brief time frame for the Magi to follow. Yep, couldn't make this kind of argument in the 3rd century when Christians got serious about when Jesus was born. There's also the comet theory. Halley's comet would have appeared in 12 BC, but another comet may have appeared in 5 or 6 BC, though this may have been the same phenomenon recorded by Chinese and Korean astrologers before. It does not appear in antiquity they had many terms to describe the variety of celestial phenomenon, so most things were just called stars. Now, in 1991, in the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society, Cambridge professor Colin Humphreys argued a comet had appeared in April of 5 BC. Now we have an argument for April. Never mind, we also got June and February as well. Now, Professor Humphrey, his argument of a comet is not what originally popularizes the talk of an April date. Rather, it's the Mormons. Probably the first proposal for an April birth was sometime in the mid-1800s by Latter-day Saints Church elder Orson Pratt, who calculated signs of Jesus' birth and death in the Book of Mormon, and he settled on April 11th as Jesus' birthday. In 1901, the Christmas message from LDS President of the First Presidency, Anthon H. Lund, mentions that he prefers the Nativity being in April, probably because he saw springtime as a good time for the Christ to be born. In 1915, Elder James E. Talmage publishes his book, Jesus the Christ, which is an exposition of the life and work of Jesus. Based on Joseph Smith's Doctrine and Covenants, section 20, published in 1835, he writes, quote, "The rise of the Church of Christ in these last days being 1,830 years since the coming of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, in the flesh, it being regularly organized and established agreeable to the laws of our country, by the will and commandment of God, in the fourth month, on the sixth day of the month, which is called April," end quote. So, according to Talmage, this would mean that 830 years since the establishment of the LDS Church in 1830, that Jesus was born on April 6, 1 BC. This argument was immediately endorsed by several elders and prominent figures in the LDS Church. Yeah, that's the whole argument. Because the LDS Church was established on April 6, 1830, and Joseph Smith's revelation from God in composing Doctrine and Covenants states that this is 1830 years since the birth of Christ, therefore Jesus was born on April 6, 1 BC. Solid argument. I hope no one thinks I'm bashing the Mormons. I'm actually fascinated by Mormonism. I think the Book of Mormon is immensely worthy of study. I actually really admire Joseph Smith, even if he's a bit of an oddball. But I like weird people. They're more interesting than boring people. And Jesus was quite the weirdo too, and I really like him. And I think it's all too easy to make fun of Mormons because they seem silly, but what doesn't seem silly if you don't believe in it? But of course it's absolutely equally arbitrary to pick April 6th as Jesus' birthday as December 25th. Again, because we have zero evidence of when he was born. And it's not accepted amongst all Mormons that Jesus was born in April. Mormons, like anyone else, are individuals and each has their own opinions, but Mormons are emphatically where we get the argument that Jesus was born in April. So was Jesus born in April? Sure. Yeah, sure. You have a 1 in 12 chance of being right, because once again, once more, say it with me, we have zero evidence of when he was born. We will likely never know when he was born. What we know is that there was a man who was born. He became a teacher and adopted an itinerant teaching style. He said and did some stuff that upset the establishment, which caused him to be executed. And he still has followers to this day. That is what we know. So the next time someone says Jesus was actually born in April, unless they're Mormon, feel free to tell them that the Mormons are the one who popularized that birth date for Jesus. It should be fun for you and a buzzkill for the rest of the Christmas party.
All right, a fantastic piece by Worshipful Brother Day here in the Masonic Mythbusting segments. I really enjoy these Christmas ones. You know what's interesting, too, is this idea, and I think he drives it home, but the idea that Christmas could be on this sixth day of April based on Jesus' birth from the Latter-day Saints' point of view is just as, I guess, arbitrary as the date of December 25th. So if you're going to laugh at one of those dates, we must laugh at both of them and recognize that we're not laughing at the day or the holiday itself, but rather the notion that we could know either one of them to be definitive. In fact, there is no definitive. And again, I think as Patrick points out in several of his myth-busting segments that we shouldn't let what we don't know about something we know to have happened spoil the actual thing. So whenever you celebrate Christmas or a season of giving, what matters most is the intent. And I think we all can agree that the intent behind why you might celebrate Christmas or the solstice or Diwali or Hanukkah or any other type of holiday that comes around at any point in the year doesn't matter as the date doesn't matter as much as the actual reason that you're celebrating. So this is important. So lastly for this week, we're going to go ahead and do a contemplative exercise. It being closer to Christmas, I think I want to pick a deck that's a little bit more Christmassy, if there is such a thing, in the world of tarot. You know, I have yet to collect maybe a tarot deck themed around Christmas. I probably should. I have like a Halloween Oracle, which is pretty cool. But let me go ahead and grab a deck that might be a little bit fun for the Christmas sort of season here. All right, so I was going to grab the Robin Wood tarot deck, but instead, due to the somewhat multiple references of, I think, things that are kind of revolving around Christmas and the holy time of year, I made this kind of random thought to pick up my Botticelli deck, which worshiper brother Joe Martinez had bought me when he went to Rome. These are a beautiful set of illuminated cards. They've got some great imagery, including things like the Death card, which really seems to me to be a tribute card to Paeta by Michelangelo. The cards almost, not just the, when I say illuminated, it's not like the edges are gold or anything like that. The actual images on the cards, all of the background has a sort of imprinting of gold inlaid edging for the symbolism, which is really quite interesting and cool. For those of you who are like, oh, what's the tarot? Why are you doing a tarot thing in a Masonic podcast? We are a trusted form of Masonic information and its kindred sciences. I will say that the tarot does appear in Mackey's as a system. It is a system that was revered by many, many Masonic practitioners of the royal art, as we might say. Just going to shuffle these up while I talk to you. And really, the cards are all just like your working tools. Each card is like a working tool in that it, where masonry has a set of tools, you might say, today I'm going to draw a Masonic card out of my Masonic deck. And that card might say the compasses. And what do the compasses represent for us in masonry? Well, we say something like, you know, the most vital parts of man are contained between the compasses, and so are those vital tenets of masonry. Brotherly love, relief, and truth have to do with your day-to-day. Are you skipping on any one of those lessons? Or something along those lines, right? So instead of those meanings, we're looking at situations and perhaps how that situation might be interpreted in your life today. And as a Mason, how you might tackle that using your Masonic working tools. So I'm just going to kind of spread these out with my left hand. I just gave them a quick shuffle. I'm just going to grab a card at random, grab this one here, and I'll put the others away. I'm going to go ahead and flip this card over, and we got the Ten of Wands, which is actually, I got it inversed. So if the card is upright, the Ten of Wands really gives you a feeling of contentment, that you are saying you're being very passive. You're not going to fight. You're content. It's not worth it. If it's upside down, it gives us two keywords, at least in the Botticelli tarot, which it says indistinguishability, meaning perhaps you have lacked to distinguish yourself different from the pack, or you have some sort of unrewarded effort. So based on that alone, if we were to say, you know, in Freemasonry, we all work pretty hard. We love to give rewards and certificates to our brothers to show our appreciation for everything that they do. It is interesting. I have seen many a time where we reward the silliest small things, but I think we're all adults, and I think it does warrant this idea that we should likely reward big efforts, things that really change stuff. maybe you've done some things for your lodge, and maybe you're feeling a little underappreciated here. That's one interpretation of the card. Now, if we go to a more contemporary meaning for the card, so contemporary meaning a more modern look at what the problem could be, or the, and when I say problem, I mean the scenario, not an actual negative problem. Wands themselves are cards that deal with manifestation, so they're always kind of seen as a masculine card. A ten of wands typically shows a person carrying ten wands. The Botticelli deck is a little bit different. It shows a person who is like kind of laying down and there's wands that surround them. But the ten of wands really does suggest, similar to what the Botticelli deck gives us as unrewarded effort, this card also means that perhaps you're doing it all. You're carrying the burden. You need to learn how to delegate. You need to release some authority. So think about this from the term of maybe a junior warden. Are you relying on your stewards as much as you could? Are you a worshipful master who is also preparing all of the education for your lodge and failing to delegate more things to your brothers? I know this is hard to talk about because I think in a lot of cases we feel like if we want something done, we have to do it ourselves. But if we're bringing the right men into Freemasonry, then we should be able to have those right men in our lodges, and they should be the right people to take on tasks that you think they can handle. So perhaps for this week, let's just say, let's try to get a little bit better about delegation and getting us to a point where we don't feel like we are carrying the burden for everything. One more time, I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. If you want to learn more about how you can assist the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out your options. That's it for this week. I hope you guys all had a great time learning a little bit about birthdays and traditional dates and reasonings for why we might put a date on a specific part of the year. And we learn a little bit more about the astrological significance of some of the things that are in our Masonic lodges from a point of science, not speculation. And I hope we can think a little bit more about how we can utilize tools like delegation. You know, this Ten of Wands might just lead us right back to that 24-inch gauge. But anyway, until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
That's it. Okay, girl.